The headlines this hour: the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution highlights the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program and says that the country will face a pressing need for nuclear energy in the future. In Albania, police notified the U.S. Embassy of the MKO terrorist cult's involvement in human and drug trafficking. And Russia says that its troops continue leaving the areas bordering Ukraine, accuses the West of creating hysteria over the alleged invasion of Ukraine. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, rejects Western claims that Iran is seeking a nuclear weapon, once again confirming that Tehran's nuclear program is entirely peaceful.
حالا اسم بیارن که این تاب تولید بمب فلان قدر فاصله داره حرفای مهمل و بی‌معناست. خودشون میدونن که ما دنبال این قضیه نیستیم، دنبال سلاح هسته‌ای نیستیم، ما دنبال بهره‌مندی صلح‌آمیز از هسته‌ای هستیم. این رو فهمیدن، تشخیص میدن، نمیخوان ملت ایران این پیشرفت بزرگ و چشمگیر علمی رو بهش دست پیدا کنه و فشار میارن.
Ayatollah Khamenei also noted that Iran will further develop its peaceful nuclear capacity to maintain its independence. Sooner or later, the leader added, the Islamic Republic will be in need of nuclear energy. Ayatollah Khamenei recalled that he had cautioned the negotiators to include certain points in the initial deal when it was being drawn up back in 2015, but that those cautions were not heeded and therefore led to subsequent problems. Iran's leader said the chief purpose of the sanctions is to weaken the Islamic Republic. He pointed out to production, collective efforts, and diplomacy as the way forward to neutralize the effects of economic pressure and sanctions. Political analyst Mostafa Khoshesh says the U.S. seeks to use Iran's nuclear program to demonize the Islamic Republic and to contain its regional and missile power.
What the Iranian leader said was reiterating, he was reiterating once again that Iran is very much resolved to maintain its peaceful nuclear program. Despite the many inspections that have been carried out on Iranian nuclear, civilian nuclear industries, that included the largest number of man hours of inspections before the JCPOA and after that, of course, United States is just using the Iranian nuclear program in order to demonize Iran without providing any kind of proof, in order to advance its containment program that consists of the ultimate objective of containing Iran's power components in various areas of nuclear industry, regional power and missile power. So Iran is in the know. Iran knows what they are doing, and it wants to, you know, diffuse their containment plan if possible. If not, as the Iranian Supreme Leader reiterated, the main road towards salvation and getting rid of these pressures is diffusing the sanctions and the impact of this weapon of choice for the United States that's reinvigorating the Iranian economy.
Iran's top negotiator in the Vienna talks is calling on other parties to be realistic and to avoid excessive demands. In a tweet, Ali Bagheri Kani said that it is time for them to take, quote, serious decisions in order to restore the 2015 accord. The diplomat says the months-long negotiations are closer than ever to an agreement. However, he stresses that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. Russia's representative to the talks, Mikhail Olyanov, has echoed Bagheri Kani's remarks, calling for final decisions to be made. Advisor to Iran's negotiating team in the Vienna talks, Mohammad Mirandi, says no matter who's in charge in Washington, U.S. policies indicate that it is an unreliable partner in any talks.
The United States can't be trusted, nor can the Europeans be trusted, because we've seen that the Europeans do whatever the United States tells them to do, whether it's Obama, when he warns financial institutions, insurance companies, shipping companies, major investment corporations not to deal with Iran. That was a violation of the nuclear deal, and the Europeans went along with it. When Trump tore up the deal, the Europeans nagged about it, but they went along with it. Under Biden, the Europeans continue to pursue Trumpian maximum pressure sanctions. We have to keep in mind that as we speak, maximum pressure sanctions against women and children continue to be implemented both by the Europeans and the Americans. So under such circumstances, there's no reason for anyone in Iran to trust the Europeans or the Americans about their nuclear commitments, about their commitments to the nuclear deal, nor can the Iranians trust them about with regards to any other form of negotiations when the Europeans and the Americans are seen as unreliable partners within the JCPOA. Then how can other issues that go beyond the nuclear program be discussed with these countries in the hope that an agreement would be respected by the Europeans and the Americans?
Albanian police have alerted the U.S. Embassy that members of a terrorist anti-Iran group known as Mujahideen Khalq Organization have been involved in various criminal activities. Albanian media reports suggest that some MKO operatives based in a camp near the capital Tirana have trafficked over 400 members to France. A number of them have been detained for trafficking people from the Middle East to Europe. Based on these reports, a senior MKO member has been arrested while trying to traffic drugs to Italy, and police have prosecuted another member over theft charges. The criminal activities happened between the years 2019 and 2021. The terrorist organization has been involved in the massacre of thousands of Iranians, including senior officials in the 1980s. The group relocated from Iraq to Albania 9 years ago. The U.S. removed MKO from its terror blacklist in the year 2012. Iran says Washington and some of its allies have been supporting the terrorist group. Historian and social activist Olsi Jazekci believes that the anti-Iran MKO terror group also poses a major security risk to the European Union.
The Mujahideens, they're trafficking probably Daesh terrorists to Europe. And the latest report by the Albanian police, which was leaked to the media, shows the worrying trend that is existing within this cult, that in a way it seems they are sending many of their young members to Europe. They are trafficking them. But these people who are being trafficked to Europe, they are not common people. They are highly trained foreign fighters, ex-terrorists, people who are trained on not only being suicide bombers, but also on using heavy weapons, tanks, helicopters, and what have you. And on the other hand, Italy is suffering a lot from Albanian mafia and drug trafficking. And now when we have high commanders of MEC, people who are very close to Mariam Rajavi and who are caught smuggling drugs to Italy, this is a major security threat for the European Union.
Hamas is blasting Australia for its decision to declare the Palestinian Resistance Movement a terrorist organization, saying that it is the Zionist regime instead that rightfully deserves the title terrorist. The Hamas spokesman Hassan Qassam says Australia's clear support for Israel shows its aggression against the Palestinian nation. He says that Hamas is a national liberation movement that is fighting occupiers in accordance with international law. The Australian government says that it is to designate the entirety of Hamas movement as a terrorist organization for what it calls concerning views and hateful ideologies. Canberra has also warned against any types of assistance to Hamas, saying that violators could face up to 25 years jail time. The U.S., Britain, and Germany are among other Western allies of Tel Aviv that have given Hamas a terrorist designation. Russia says it keeps on withdrawing troops from areas near the Ukrainian border and sending them back to their permanent bases after drills. The Russian Defense Ministry says 10 convoys of troops left the Crimean Peninsula on Thursday. This is the latest reported drawdown of troops deployed along the Ukrainian border. Russia TV showed columns of military hardware crossing a recently constructed bridge connecting the peninsula to the Russian mainland. The Russian foreign minister has slammed the West for its continued hysteria over an alleged imminent invasion of Ukraine.
Our servicemen calmly deployed on their own territory. They conducted military exercises. Then they packed their tents, loaded their equipment onto rails, and started leaving. But the hysteria continues.
Earlier this week, Moscow announced the withdrawal of some of its troops, saying that it was open to diplomacy. Kiev and its Western allies, including the U.S.-led NATO, however, say that they have not seen any meaningful pullback of Russian forces. The NATO chief, Jens Stoltenberg, has once again accused Russia of trying to create a pretext for an invasion of Ukraine. On Thursday, Washington also accused Russia of stocking up blood supplies, moving troops closer to Ukraine, and flying in more combat aircraft. The U.S. envoy to the U.N. claimed Moscow was moving toward an imminent invasion. Moscow denies the allegations, accusing NATO of provocative movements along Russian borders. From Brussels, Jerome Hughes joins us. Jerome, we were just covering a piece of news on the conflict about how the UK has talked about a false flag. Do you have any information on that? And, of course, the details behind the most recent developments regarding the Ukraine crisis.
That's right, Cave. Well, Liz Truss, the British Foreign Secretary, has been speaking in Kiev. She's speaking at the moment, in fact, but she held a joint press conference with her Ukrainian counterpart in the past hour. And she's talking about this false flag operation from Russia. But, I mean, it's very unclear. I mean, Russia has been clear from the start that these are military drills taking place within its own territory and in the territory of an ally in the form of Belarus, which is perfectly normal for countries with sort of agreeable positions to carry out cooperative drills. We see that with NATO all the time, with NATO allies, and we see a buildup of NATO troops further and further east, which is very provocative, analysts say, in terms of Russia's position. But, you know, you see at the moment, for example, I think we're going to hear more from the EU side, more concrete information later today, because what's happening at the moment is you have an EU-Africa leaders summit taking place in Brussels today and tomorrow. And the first day of it is certainly being overshadowed by the situation with Ukraine, because we're told that EU leaders are holding informal talks in relation to what's happening. But you see the rhetoric is being constantly built up. I mean, Liz Truss talked about the fact that Joe Biden said last week that Nord Stream 2, that it will be blocked if there is an invasion of Ukraine. And of course, the West talks a lot about, you know, Ukraine being a sovereign, independent, autonomous nation, which is fair enough. But at the same time, you have a private contract between Germany and Russia in terms of Nord Stream 2, a gas pipeline, which has nothing to do with the EU. It has nothing to do with the United States. And yet you have Joe Biden saying that it will be blocked. Well, where's the autonomy? Where's the independence of Germany? Where's the respect for Germany's independence in this regard? And then you have Liz Truss parroting the same sentiments just in the past hour. So there's a lot of hypocrisy going here. And as EU leaders meet, and as NATO defense ministers hold their final day of meetings here in Brussels today as well, it's clear that there are divisions, because just one country, but there are several. I mean, you have the likes of Hungary, who would certainly see, would certainly have sympathy for the Russian side of things in terms of Russia trying to protect its own borders, trying to protect its own regional security interests. And yet you have countries like that being pushed down, like Viktor Orban is being certainly battered down by his colleagues, because at the end of the day, Hungary is one of the it takes a lot of money from the European Union, and therefore money has a big game to play in this as well, that the people that would like to have a stronger voice perhaps in favor of Russia are being shot down for economic reasons. They're being threatened that, you know, if you don't toe the line, if you don't show solidarity and support, that there will be economic consequences. And so, you know, and Germany as well, I mean, Olaf Scholz, the German Chancellor, it's clear that he recognizes Germany is one of the richest countries in the world. So, I mean, for the United States to be able to say it can dictate what Germany does seems a little bit rich indeed. But, you know, Germany realizes it's pragmatic. It realizes that regardless of all these talks of, you know, alternative energy sources coming into the EU from, alternatives to Russia, that's not realistic. In the medium term, it's definitely not realistic, because all the pipelines are in place, all the infrastructure is there in place. The EU is getting very cheap energy from Russia. Germany knows this, and Germany wants to increase, actually, the supply of this cheap Russian gas coming in. And yet also Germany, there's massive pressure from NATO, from the EU, on Germany to toe the line. So, you know, the rhetoric is continuing. Russia is continuing to say, and its ambassadors around the world are saying, that there are no plans to invade Ukraine. And yet you have to ask the question, are there people in NATO that would actually like to see a conflict? Because when you see this rhetoric building up over and over again, it really does beg the question, are there warmongers inside NATO that would actually love to see Russia invade Ukraine?
Thank you very much for that, Jerome Hughes. We appreciate it. Jerome Hughes there from Brussels. Many thanks. France and its allies have announced that they would withdraw their troops from Mali following nearly a decade of their military presence in the African country. In a statement, France and its African and European partners cited multiple obstructions by Mali's ruling junta for their decision. The French president also said the attitudes of the junta forced his country to pull out its troops. Emmanuel Macron completely rejected the idea that France failed its former colony. Relations between the two countries have been strained since the 2020 coup in Mali. Local officials have already demanded French troops leave Mali. There have also been public protests calling for the withdrawal of the French military. France deployed troops in its former colony in 2013 under the pretext of fighting terrorists, but Paris-led operations failed to quell violence there. A number of British Muslim teaching staff are demanding a new public inquiry after an investigative podcast revealed that government ministers may have fueled an Islamophobic purge based on a fabricated extremist plot. Notorious Trojan Horse affair rocked Britain in 2014 and led the way for the hostile anti-Muslim climate which affects ordinary British Muslims today. We come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Scientists say more must be done to eliminate the chemicals which have a devastating impact on marine life and can end up in the food chain. We have prepared for you an article written by David Lucille. The piece is titled, How Forever Chemicals Are Using Marine Life to Travel the World by Sea. Scientists found women in the remote Faroe Islands had unusually high concentrations of toxic industrial chemicals in their breast milk. It seemed a surprising discovery. The North Atlantic archipelago, which lies between Iceland and the northern tip of Scotland, is far from sources of industrial or chemical pollution. And the chemicals that the 2005 Stockholm University study measured, which included polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs, had already been phased out in many countries. So how did this happen? The chemicals were coming from the ocean, or more specifically, from the pilot whales that make up an important part of the Faroe Islanders' diet. PCBs, or polychlorinated biphenyls, part of a group of toxic chemicals called persistent organic pollutants, or POPs, are able to travel huge distances around the planet through air and water, affecting communities far away from the source of contamination. They make their way into the sea, building up in the fatty tissues of marine animals. Once in the food chain, these chemicals can biomagnify as they pass from prey to hunter, reaching higher concentrations in top predators. That is why it can be riskier to regularly eat large marine animals, such as tuna or pilot whales, in the case of the Faroe Islanders, than, say, mackerel, anchovies or sardines. Inui living in the Canadian Arctic have also been found to have higher POP level in their bloodstream than the general population of Canada, predominantly due to their diet of fish and marine mammals such as walrus and narwhal. What is happening in Canada and in the Faroe Islands is one snapshot of the dangers of a group of chemicals that have, it turns out, an outsized impact on people, wildlife, food chains and the entire ecosystems. In the 1920s, polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, a family of 209 synthetic industrial chemicals, were developed for use as cooling fluids and flame retardants in machinery, electric goods, paints, and building materials. Stable, non-flammable, and heat-resistant, the chemicals had multiple uses. But that stability, once such a positive attribute, meant they did not disappear or degrade even long after production had ceased. After peaking in the 1960s, use of polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs began to decline from the 1970s as the health effects became more apparent and countries banned the chemicals. Scientists started to link polychlorinated biphenyls to negative effects on immune systems of animals and people, endocrine disruption, reduced fertility, neurodevelopmental problems, and reduced IQ in children. They have also been classified as a probable carcinogen. Today, most polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs are found in sealed landfill sites, old electrical equipment, and prefabricated buildings made before the 1980s. Unless you live very close to an industrial or agricultural site, your most likely source of PCBs is your food. A list of 12 persistent organic pollutants, or POPs, known as the Dirty Dozen, including PCBs and the synthetic insecticide DDT, were banned in 2004 by an international treaty, the Stockholm Convention. And more chemicals have since been added. To date, 185 parties have signed a treaty, promising to implement control measures. But even with widespread bans, pollution continues to spread. Some chemicals face production restrictions, such as DDT, which cannot be manufactured or applied as an insecticide in agriculture in most countries, but can still be used to control malaria. Others are being eliminated. The treaty calls for polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, to be phased out in equipment by 2025. and all PCBs to be eliminated by 2028. But so far, the treaty has not succeeded in turning off the tap for much of this toxic pollution. According to the United Nations Environment Programme, only 17% of the total amount of polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs has been eliminated worldwide, with 83% or 14 million tons still to be dealt with. An estimated 1 million tons of PCB-contaminated material are waiting to be destroyed in Europe alone. The most effective way to get rid of polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs is by incineration at extremely high temperatures, an expensive and sometimes logistically impossible process. But unless existing stocks of chemicals are dealt with and disposed of appropriately, they will eventually end up in the environment. Already the ocean acts as a PCB sink, but so far only a tiny proportion of the legacy contaminant has entered the marine environment. As buildings and materials are destroyed and dumped, more polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs will continue to leach into waterways. The climate crisis may play an aggravating role, speeding up the movement of chemicals around the planet. As temperatures rise, persistent organic pollutants or POPs will evaporate even more easily into the atmosphere. In the future, this grasshopper effect, by which pollutants evaporate in warmer regions and travel in air currents to cooler places, could have an even greater impact on people, animals, and places thousands of miles away from the source of the pollution. A scientific paper by Paul Jepson, a veterinary specialist in wildlife population health at the Zoological Society of London, and his colleagues, published last year, reveals that polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs were found in every single one of the 1,081 dolphins, porpoises and killer whales they studied. Of these, about 55% of the harbour porpoises, most of the strip dolphins and bottlenose dolphins and all of the killer whales had higher levels of PCB, levels that were greater than 9 milligrams of PCB per kilogram of their lipid or body fat. It is above this level that traces of PCB can have biological consequences for certain species. But many killer whales have far higher concentrations, typically between 10 and 100 times above the 9 milligram per kilogram threshold. Lulu, the killer whale, had PCBs measuring 957 milligrams per kilogram of lipid. Paul Jepson, a veterinary specialist at the Zoological Society of London, said, "At these levels, species stop reproducing. This probably accounts for why Lulu's pod produced no calves. The nightmare scenario. Ultimately, if species stop reproducing, they become extinct." Studies coming out of the United States are now considering what impact, if any, PCBs may be having on human health. Paul Jepson said, "In the United States, there is a lot of scientific evidence showing the toxic effect of high polychlorinated biphenyls or PCB human health, but this approach has yet to be replicated in Europe." The Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, website acknowledges that people who ingest fish may be exposed to polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs that have bioaccumulated in the fish they're ingesting. Tackling the problem is a daunting prospect. The chemicals can be destroyed only in high-temperature incinerators, which are found in only a few countries. Polluting per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances that escape into the ocean often come back to shore when released into the air from the sea spray aerosols of crashing waves. This boomerang effect is further evidence that toxic chemicals do not get diluted by the sea. While legislation is slow, more stringent preventive measures are urgently needed to make sure the emerging pollutants in use today will not become the legacy contaminants of the future.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Dispossession, the great social housing swindle directed by Paul Sung. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him is Claudia Webb, who is a Labour Party councillor in the London Borough of Islington. Now, Dispossession is a documentary that explores the catastrophic failures by successive governments that have led to a chronic shortage of social housing in Britain. The film focuses on the neglect, demolition and regeneration of council estates across the UK and investigates how the state works with the private sector to demolish council estates to build the land they stand on, making properties that are unaffordable to the majority of people.
They're going to regenerate it, which means total demolition. And when it very first started, it was a case of nothing will happen without your approval. Well, that was lie number one on day one, and it's never changed.
We've got councils of all kinds across London who are trying to demolish traditional council estates. They're actually destroying communities.
It was Mrs. Thatcher whose right to buy scheme was a vote winner for families like the Pattersons. She gave them the title deeds to their council house. They gave her tea in return.
Don't you think this is lovely?
The right to buy was probably the most popular policy ever introduced by Conservative government.
Housing is a fundamental human need, and it's one that the market just doesn't seem to be capable of providing.
We should be building every year about 240,000, 250,000 homes, and we're nowhere near that.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
Essentially, we've had successive governments that simply haven't seen the role for social housing, and they've been cutting it.
It's not seen as being aspirational, and aspiration is the key word.
For the last 10, 20 years, housing stock that used to be here is down, it's gone.
Access to housing in Glasgow, to social housing, is nigh on impossible.
They are tearing apart our community, brick by brick, and we're not going to let them!
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a very serious problem facing this country. And it was a very moving and deeply personal documentary for the director, I believe, as he grew up on a council estate. And especially in the wake of the Grenfell Tower tragedy, this film comes at a very important time. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I was very impressed by it. I thought the first time I saw this film, I was a little bit concerned about how compacted it was, the amount of information it crams into an hour and, I think, 26 minutes. The second time I saw it, I was impressed by the amount of information that it did get in, the amount of ground that it covers, the fact that it covers all these issues from so many different angles. I mean, you're getting the input of the politicians who have to make the policy decisions that that cause estates to be built or to be knocked down. Mm-hmm. You're also getting the input from people on the ground, residents of the estates, who have a very different take on it. So I'm a big fan of this film.
So as you say, this documentary, it was very dense, packed with information, statistics, and usually these films are quite difficult to watch. So do you think the director was successful in conveying his message then?
Yes, because in part I think that it makes its points pictorially. I mean, it is very crisply shot, and it's one of those situations where I think if we're walking down a street anywhere, this is the kind of issue that hits you smack in the face. You know, we could go for a walk around the studios here and we would see 3, 4, 5 luxury flat developments, springing up everywhere. But we'd probably see more homeless people than we'd see social housing developments going up. And the film is very acutely attuned to what is actually happening at street level, and it shows you the disrepair that many estates have fallen into, and it contrasts that with the slightly sort of eerie gloom of these new developments going up that don't seem to be inhabited by anyone because no one's got the money to afford to move in there.
And Claudia, if I could turn to you now, as someone who works closely with this issue, is the social housing crisis in this country as bad as the documentary suggests it is?
Well, the documentary highlights quite well, actually, the state of play of council housing and council house in the UK, and in particular, actually, in London, and the sort of the dilemma that councils face as against the sort of the notion of community, the notion of identity, and the notion of neighbourhood, the concept of fairness. Right at the very heart of an urban inner city area, and what does a home mean? And it begins to explore what that means today, mm-hmm. as against what it should have meant, and what we've got really in terms of what the documentary is portraying and what the film's portraying is this whole issue of council homes being sold off for profit. Council land being sold off for profit and exposing really a reality and dichotomy of huge waiting lists, homelessness, mm-hmm. And yet council homes being sold off for profit against that sort of waiting list, mm-hmm. and then what happens to communities and what happens to neighbourhoods. It's a stark contrast, and the film has really brought home and brought out the realities of the dangers of making the wrong decisions.
Indeed, and this documentary, one of the key messages is that a home is a right and not a privilege.
We need to offer housing to people at lower rates than full market cost. And the way historically we've done that is we've built social housing. We provided housing to people that the state has some direct investment in, on the premise that not everybody can afford to rent at full market cost or indeed afford to purchase their own home.
The current government has slashed investment in social housing so much that the housing crisis can only get worse. The only solution is to invest in social housing again, both through local authorities to build council homes and through housing associations to build social homes, in the way that the post-war government invested. And they need to be homes that people can afford, not homes that are called affordable, which are not.
If you build a council estate and people move in, those people pay rent to the local authority. After a few years, then the cost of building has paid for itself. Whereas if you have private rent, A, it's a lot more expensive, B, that money goes straight into landlords' pockets and doesn't get reinvested. It's a really good economic model, and it also points to the fact that housing should be a right for everybody.
In this documentary, we learn there's various misconceptions about social housing. Claudia, if I could ask you, why is there a need for social housing?
Well, social housing is really relevant in a local area where people, in a sense, can't afford to live in a home unless housing is provided that meets their ability to pay for that home. And in a sense, what we've got is a growing population and a basic need. And a basic need is a roof over your head. And if councils are deprived from building homes, then in a sense what you've got is demand outstripping supply. And really what the documentary highlighted by showing clips of Margaret Thatcher, it highlights Thatcherism and the policies of Thatcherism, which at the time was
the right to buy scheme.
Which was one, the issue about right to buy, but two, under Thatcherism, they stopped councils from building council homes. Councils used to be a machine for council homes. So within local authorities, you not only saw the production of homes, but you also saw the architects, the builders, the quantity surveyors, all of the professional skill sets located within a council. Those skill sets have long gone.
And thank you for that point and shedding light on the need for social housing. And Mike, if I can turn to you now, we learned from the film that there are various stigmatisms about social housing. What are they? So what are some of these stigmatisms?
Well, one of the issues that the film addresses very well is the recent rise of TV shows like Benefit Street and things like that, where people who live on housing estates are, you know, it's these places are called sink estates, and you know there's a certain stigma that goes with that. But there's a portrayal of people who live on estates as feckless and you know alcoholic, and you know someone who
scrounges.
Exactly, that's the kind of show. And these shows are very cheap to produce, like all reality TV, very cheap to produce, can get syndicated and make a TV channel or production company lots of money. What they actually give back to a society, a country, a community, very little. It's you know, to stigmatize the people who appear on these shows and people who live on council estates in general. And I think part of that is that because these shows are made by people from outside those communities looking in. And it's often, as the film suggests, people who actually live on council estates, they have a community, they have a life there, they know where they're going, they know, you know, where their house relates to other people, the people who live next door to them. And it's not a sink estate. They're not circling the plug hole. You know, they're getting by. These places are functional, but they're being depicted in such a way as to suggest that they're not, and that they need knocking down.
We're going to continue this discussion in the next part.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
In his first public speech following Labour's landslide victory in 1997's general election, Tony Blair stood on the Aylesbury estate in south-east London and vowed there would be no forgotten people in the Britain his party wanted to build. 20 years later, residents of the Aylesbury might wonder what happened to New Labour's bold vision of the future. Since 2001, campaigners have fought against Southwark Council's plans to regenerate the estate. The council argued that the Aylesbury needs to be demolished due to the high cost of essential repairs. Campaigners claim that the council allowed the estate to deteriorate in order to facilitate its demise and justify a £1.5 billion redevelopment project.
So we saw Tony Blair there. And Claudia, I have to ask you, why didn't Blair fulfil his promises?
Well, I mean, I think the reality is that when, in 1997, Labour came into power in the aftermath of Thatcherism, in the aftermath of councils not being invested in to build council housing. And, you know, one could have wished and hoped that the new policy of Labour would have been to enable councils to build council homes again. A good council will build good quality homes, and with the resources and the investment, will invest in the stock that it has. But equally, if designs aren't right, and you know designs for their time aren't always fit for the future, and you then need to think about how do you make that housing stock work? How do you make it livable and continue to be enjoyable? But equally, what's important is, and what I fundamentally believe in, is if you are going to regenerate an estate, then what you need to bring back is council housing. You regenerate the estate to create continued council homes, and that we shouldn't need to, as councils, go into business with the private sector and sell off the land and sell off the homes for profit. And that's what councils need investment, so they don't have to do that. Maybe that they weren't presented with was the investment that was necessary to rebuild council homes rather than engage in a partnership with the private sector.
So you're saying that the Labour Party, the new Labour back then, effectively inherited this crisis. But Mike, from the documentary, I get the sense that the Conservative Party are much to blame, but do Labour share as much blame also?
Well, one of the strengths of the film is that it recognises that this is essentially a non-partisan issue. You know, everyone, whether you're of the right or of the left, needs a roof above your head. And I think it recognises, as much as, you know, Labour and the Conservatives like to play this fun game on Question Time of blaming one another for previous policies, there is a degree to which both parties are to blame, and this is why we're in the situation that we're in now. That yes, that right to buy scheme was, although a huge success at the time, has proven to have taken so many properties out of the public sphere and put them in private hands. But I think at the same time, the film says that, you know, when Tony Blair did come into power, not enough was done to counteract that policy. It was seen as such a sort of overwhelming success. What can you do? You know, well, you could build more houses, and I think that was one of the issues that leads to the situation that we're in right now, that we simply don't have enough houses for the people who need them.
And another, I want to talk about a different aspect of the documentary now. And one of the effects of the housing crisis seems to be the dismantling of the sense of community. I get this sense from the documentary that the film suggests that there were outside parties that were directly targeting and sort of dividing the community in order to conquer it. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is... In some ways, what the film is talking about is the direction of the entire nation over the past 50 years. I mean, we're told very early on that a lot of social housing was built close to factories, close to industries. And of course, once those industries closed down in the 60s, 70s, 80s, the last decade or so, where do the people who live on those estates go now? You know, how do they pay their rent? And if they can't pay their rents, does someone come in and take their property away from them? So that it's raising bigger questions than just questions around housing. It's about, you know, who, you know, how much responsibility do councils have for the people who live in within their remit?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll just have to pause there again just for now. I'll let you get back to that point, Claudia.
As the estate falls into decay, I believe it was a deliberate strategy of the local authority because they saw the Elephant Castle at the time as a prime market for real estate.
I haven't got all the details on the Haygate, but my understanding is that some of the social rented properties will be built in another part of the borough. But again, it's around the fact that if we are going to take down a certain number of social rented properties, it's about making sure we're re-providing that, actually re-providing more for the same level of rent.
For the demolition of 9,000 plus council homes, and their replacement with luxury apartments costing £600,000 and £700,000 as an entry price, was their answer to the problem. That's no answer to the 9,000, 10,000 tenants that were living in secure accommodation at the time that are now dispersed across London, and many dispersed outside of London.
People who benefit from the housing crisis are, of course, property developers. They want to have the densest housing possible. And the best way to make dense housing is to build luxury apartments and to make it look like, you know, you're building a tall tower block, not to house many families as they did in the 60s and 70s, but to give a really slick community lifestyle.
Now, before we went to that clip, we were just talking about the notion of dismantling of the community by the outside parties. Claudia, did you agree with what Mike said?
Well, I mean, I have a different take on it because obviously we're in, my context is London, and I can see that in areas like Newark, in Nuneaton, for example, which had a coal industry, that if you create homes around a particular industry and then that industry disappears in terms of the mining industry, then you are left with homes and people without access to meaningful work. That's not the case in London. What you've got in London is a total land grab. It's a disgrace, really, in terms of a total land grab by big developers who are basically capitalising on the opportunity that is presented by the lack of inability of councils to build and invest in homes. The policy of not allowing councils to build homes That is what's been problematic, because it's been over decades and not over a few years. What we have now in places like my own borough, where we have a good council that is building good quality homes, we bucked the trend and we sought to build council homes, and we sought to find ways to do that and ensure that we do not sell off council land. But where we have planning, where we give planning permissions to the developers, where they've got their own private land, what unfortunately has been created historically over time is the notion of poor doors. We have a policy of 50% of that must be affordable. Affordable meaning, you know, social rent properties. And what they do is they build that integral to the development, but they build it on the side or at the back, and that's where the creation of poor doors happens.
Of course,
it's
you're in Jeremy Corbyn's borough, and he's pledged to end the housing crisis. But I want to talk about this notion now in the film of social cleansing, which seems to be a contentious, controversial term, which means that low-income workers are being driven out of the capital, London, because of the soaring rents and the interests of corporations, of course, and real estate agents. What do we learn in the film about this?
The film's very good on gentrification and how neighbourhoods have changed rapidly over the last 10, 15, 20 years. So, you know, social housing is of less concern than attracting middle-class renters with lots of disposable income who can afford coffee and hummus and all the treats of living in the inner cities. But you know, there is a degree to which housing policy seems to have been skewed specifically, almost exclusively, towards that particular demographic. And of course, that, you know, drives out people who are originally living there. And you know, that's one of the many big issues that this film addressed.
Well, part of that was, you know, the whole huge banking crisis that happened. You know, what happened after the banking crisis was in London. Then that, you know, London's property market was then used as the place where people invest. And so what you've got is overseas investors purchasing land and property, never ever living in those properties, and creating a this and them scenarios and situations. What is a disgrace is when it's set against that. So you've already got that as a problem going on. Set against that is when councils have got land and homes in council control. What is a disgrace is councils then selling that off in some kind of partnership with the private sector.
It is such a complex issue.
It is.
And unfortunately, we're running out of time in this programme. And just final 30 seconds to Mike. Would you recommend this documentary?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're now in a situation where the Evening Standard can run a front page about house prices going up as though that's some great triumph. To me, it looks more and more like a tragedy, and this film absolutely reflects that.
Well, thank you very much for your time and joining the show. And I'm afraid that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.